I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today, moving on from rice, considering mental health care and dialysis machines in Burma and China. But first, the general election is on here in the U.S. Senator John McCain is at a private campaign event in Washington, D.C. It's called Aviators for McCain. And Senator Barack Obama kicks off a two-week tour with a speech about the economy in North Carolina. The first time he's been the only Democrat in the field, Hillary Clinton ending her run this past weekend. John Harwood is chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and a political writer for The New York Times. He joins us on his cell phone from Raleigh, North Carolina, the site of the Obama event. John, Obama on the stump talking the economy, John McCain in Washington with military men. Are you surprised?
Not surprised at all. You see each of these candidates going to their strength. John McCain's profile as a former war hero is on national security. He's going to try to press the argument that Barack Obama is inexperienced and naive in dealing with foreign countries to the detriment of U.S. security. Barack Obama is going to argue that John McCain doesn't understand the economy, and he's going to try to attack him as somebody whose policies show that he's out of touch.
Well, you write today that one aspect that was missing from the primary season was partisanship fueled by ideology, and that today's sort of like the starting gate for ideology entering the campaign. What do you see the clashes as being?
Well, really, what you have in primaries are arguments between candidates who don't disagree with one another very much. So Obama and Hillary Clinton sound much the same notes on policy, economically and otherwise. So did John McCain and fellow Republicans. Now we get a real clash between, on the one side, Democrats looking for greater activism on the economy, greater levels of spending and taxation in some cases, Republicans making the case for the free market, trying to say that Democrats would hurt the economy with their tax and spend policies. That's a familiar clash, and it's one that's very powerful of driving the votes of Democrats and Republicans across the country.
Are we going to hear about issues that we just didn't hear about in the primary season? For instance, abortion. McCain has spoken about his opposition to abortion very quietly, trying to draw support from evangelicals without turning off, you know, disenfranchised Democrats. Are we going to hear those issues surface?
I think you will in some places with some audiences, but John McCain's going to tread carefully on the abortion issue, because he's going to be competing with Barack Obama for the votes of independents as well as trying to rally his own base. I would expect that he would place more emphasis on other issues to try to rally those conservative Christian voters, things like the federal judiciary, saying he's going to appoint conservative judges. It's another way of talking about abortion without mentioning abortion specifically.
Well, and Obama has to win over working-class whites and women who were Clinton supporters. What issues do you hear him raising?
Skepticism of trade deals, desire to raise taxes on Wall Street and the wealthy. All of those things tend to unite Democrats right now. And so what Barack Obama is going to try to do is go to those working class whites who supported Hillary Clinton in the primaries and remind them why they were voting in Democratic primaries in the first place. There's a reason those people are Democrats. That's what Barack Obama is trying to cash in on, even though they didn't back him in the primaries.
Well, Barack Obama is also focusing on many Republican strongholds, North Carolina, as we said, Missouri, Montana. He wants to present himself as post-partisan. So doesn't he have to sort of stay away from the landmine issues?
He does in some places. He will go more for those landmine issues, if you will, in the older style industrial battlegrounds, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania. But he is going to try to be postpartisan and take advantage of the rise of independent voters, especially moderate suburbanites, in states like Colorado, where he's trying to expand Democrats' reach. Other opportunities include Nevada, New Mexico, and Virginia, where he's hoping for the heavy turnout among African Americans.
You mentioned John McCain courting evangelicals. We read a story in today's New York Times about an evangelical activist in Ohio courted by McCain's campaign who wants to wait and see who McCain picks as a running mate before deciding her vote. You know, isn't that risky for him to be courting to the right in his party, given how he was so burned by the evangelical preachers Hagee and Parsley?
John McCain faces risks on all sides in this election. The Republican brand is down. The proportion of Americans identifying themselves as Republican is lower than it was 4 years ago. So he has to unite his party, but he also needs to get those independent voters. And how effectively he strikes that balance is going to be the key to how successful he can be this fall.
John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, a political writer for The New York Times, also author of Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power. And by the way, John, can you feel the difference that a weekend makes? Does it feel completely different to you out there now?
No question about it. This is the time when many more Americans are going to tune into this process. It's not an inside discussion between Democrats on the one hand and Republicans on the other. This is the debate for the whole country.
John, thank you.
My pleasure.
It's now been over a month since Cyclone Nargis hit Burma, killing over 100,000 people, leaving over 2 million in desperate need of food, water, and shelter. China's massive earthquake is fading from the headlines, but each region is grappling with new issues, and aid organizations are trying to respond. Dr. Nicholas De Torrente is Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA. He joins us in the studio for an update. Nicholas, so nice to speak with you again.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to start with mental health, something, you know, we just don't think about. We talk about food, water, and shelter, but what is happening to the Burmese people who were impacted by the cyclone?
People are traumatized. They've lost everything, and there's this uncertainty about what's going to happen next. They're supposed to be planting. The rice season, the planting season is coming up. It's a very important moment. They aren't able to do so. They have no seeds, no tools. And many of them are actually traumatized, the loss of family members, the uncertainty about the future, and they do need to receive some assistance in coping with this.
When you say traumatized, you know, reading that people are wandering around in Yangon, formerly Rangoon, struck dumb. They can't speak. It's so deep that it's hard to even express. They just can't speak.
People who experience such disasters, such catastrophes, react in different ways, and coping mechanisms are different, and the resilience of individuals and communities are different. So some of them are really, you know, left without the possibility of picking themselves up. One of our psychologists went to the Delta and came back with this story of a woman who said, well, you know, you always ask us about our needs. You ask us about rice, but where's the will to eat the rice? Oh. And where's my will to do that? And it's hard to project yourself in the future when a lot of what was your normal life has been wiped out.
Well, and we understand that Doctors Without Borders is going to start trauma counseling and psychosocial support and mental health support, which is probably going to be new to this culture.
Yes, that's where we have to be very delicate and we have to find the right approach, because the need is there. There are techniques that seem to be effective in other disasters, and it'll be a question of adapting them to the situation.
Look at China briefly. You know, we hear so much, but you have come across something that I don't think we've heard about, the need for a certain kind of medical treatment.
Different natural disasters obviously have different consequences on people. And one thing that happens in an earthquake, especially in a place like China, where houses were built with concrete and stones and so on, is that when people are pulled out, it happens that their kidneys are overwhelmed because they've been crushed under the rubble. And to put it in a very simple way, the toxins that have accumulated kind of overwhelmed their kidney function. And so they do need special care, dialysis. And so we've been partnering with a team in Europe that goes out specifically to treat what is called crush syndrome in these instances. And they found that the Chinese medical system had nephrologists, kidney specialists, they had dialysis machines, and they needed some advice on dealing with this particular syndrome. But the response by the Chinese government, but also society, and I think that's really the new thing here, because we of course know about the army and in natural disasters in China in the past, but we haven't seen such a huge social response, society-wide response to a disaster like this in China before.
Well, let's talk about the political aspects of what you do and go back to Burma, a repressive regime there. Do you worry that in helping the government in Myanmar, you're helping this repressive regime survive? Your eyes just flashed at me. But I want to remind people, Doctors Without Borders split off from the Red Cross because some doctors then felt the Red Cross didn't react quickly enough to a possible genocide in Biafra. Others say, you know, rescue organizations aren't supposed to be political. So what kinds of decisions do you make before you go into an area?
Well, you're asking a series of very, relevant and tough questions that we always face. Our goal is to try, obviously, very simply, to try to help people who are undergoing, an acute crisis and help them in that particular period. And our aid is directed at them. And that's why we ideally want to be able to, go in, identify the needs ourselves, not be told where the needs are, We want to be able to deliver the assistance ourselves and not hand over our aid to an authority. And we want to be able to monitor what's happening. And that's the struggle for what, you know, some people call humanitarian space. That's what, you know, these parameters that you need to have to be able to make sure that your aid is actually directed at people. And when it is, the side effects that we're trying to avoid, which is strengthening a regime, for instance, are by and large avoided. So this is what we fought for in Myanmar. We wanted to make sure that they were not diverting aid. So we have to be very pragmatic. If we stand on the sidelines and announce a series of great principles and we will not do anything unless so-and-so is met, we will be ineffective. The option is between doing what we can and doing nothing. And in this case, we definitely feel that the good outweighs the bad.
Well, you know, that question of unintended consequences was raised by writer David Reif, who wrote a book asking just that. When do humanitarian organizations have unintended consequences of their work? He cites Sudan, where a lot of humanitarian agencies joined with the UN to create Operation Lifeline Sudan. But Reif and others said, well, that just freed up the warlords to slaughter, you know, because they didn't have to feed and take care of the people. Someone else was doing that.
Well, I mean, the issue of whether aid prolongs war is a really tough question. From my experience, and I think the experience of the organization, I think there's no question that aid can play into the dynamics of the situation and can be used. And we have had experiences ourselves as Doctors Without Borders. For us, the most traumatic one and one that led us to actually withdraw from the country was in 1985 in the Ethiopian famine, where we felt that our assistance was being used by the Ethiopian government, the communist government at the time, to attract people who were starving and to forcibly then relocate them from the north of the country where the famine was taking place, the famous camps that everyone remembers, to the south. And there we felt that, you know, our responsibility was very much compromised in this situation, and we decided to pull out. Those are rare instances. They're extreme cases. They exist. I do not think that aid is such a big contributor that it actually changes the motivations of, let's say, the Sudanese government or the rebel groups in Sudan who are fighting over stakes that are much, much, much larger than just the control of an aid operation or looting a few vehicles that we have. I mean, you know, they're fighting over territory, over political and economic resources that are far greater than what the aid organizations provide. But it's a real issue, and we really have to try to avoid as much as possible that our aid is misused and diverted. It's a constant responsibility that we have.
Nicholas De Torrente, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA. Some news here. 5 UN helicopters fanned out in remote areas of Burma today delivering aid. Until now, the government there has allowed only one helicopter in. And in China, additional soldiers were sent to try to drain that still-rising lake that formed after the earthquake there and threatens lives downstream. We'll be back with more with Nicholas. Later today, essayist David Sedaris out with a terrific new book and questions about his truthiness. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more on the humanitarian situation in Burma and China after both nations were struck by natural disasters last month. Our guest is Nicholas De Torrente, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA. We also want to ask him about the world food crisis. For instance, if aid organizations have come up with a miracle cure, a paste that doesn't require water to deliver nutrients to starving kids, why isn't more of that paste given out? But Nicholas, first, just before the break, we were asking about the unintended consequences of humanitarian work, which sometimes end up helping repressive regimes. The French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner, one of the founders of Doctors Without Borders, was among those who raised another question. He talked about humanitarian intervention in Burma. What was his rationale, and what do you think about that?
The logical construct that Kouchner was putting forward, and others who espoused the same line, was to say, look, the denial of assistance by the Burmese government amounts to crimes against humanity because people, if aid does not get in now, are dying at this moment by the hundreds and the thousands. And therefore, all means necessary are required to get aid delivered. That was already a false kind of juxtaposition because clearly, yes, people did need assistance, but it was not the case that after natural disaster, we've seen it in Katrina, we've seen another in tsunami, that people, you know, die from one day to the next if they don't receive aid there. That's not the case. And the huge outbreaks that were predicted do not automatically happen after a natural disaster. So he was exaggerating, I think, the humanitarian situation to make a case for armed intervention. So already that's a problem. The second problem is that, you know, you may be able to, in this case, send in, you know, helicopters and military assets into the situation. And it does happen in a natural disaster that military assets are useful. But politically, you're starting a war. I mean, you know, there will be a reaction on the other side. And we know the unintended consequences of good, you know, or supposedly just wars or wars that are started for the advancement of humanitarian causes. We have many examples of those. And we know that it's not so easy that you can just go in and fix things. And this tendency to try to fix every problem with a military solution, I think we have to look at it a bit carefully. And we did not see that as a helpful suggestion. Yes, you needed to put pressure and exert leverage over the Burmese government. But a threatening invasion to provide assistance was not the right way to go.
Dr. Nicolas de Torrente, Executive Director of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, USA. I just want to ask you one last thing, and it has to do with the food summit that just took place, world leaders gathering, and your group was recommending that there be a quick reaction to children around the world under the age of 2 who are suffering malnutrition. What's the disconnect? Why aren't they getting what they need?
Well, I think our main point was that, yes, the rising food prices are a big concern, and yes, they will impact on the ability of poor families to feed their kids. But we already have an emergency. We already have, you know, undernutrition contributing to between a third and a half of all deaths of kids under 5 every year. And that, you know, that is a very big amount. It's between 3 and 5 million kids who are dying because they're not getting the proper nutrition they need already.
Well, we understand that conventional food aid doesn't include specific foods
right.
for young children. Why? What is it that they need that's not coming in conventional
well,
aid?
Well, as we know from feeding our kids in this country, young growing kids need the full complement of micronutrients, and they need milk or an animal source food. And that, if they don't have that, then they really have a nutritional deficiency. And currently, International Food Aid basically gives cereals and fortified flours, but does not give food that is specifically targeted for young kids. So we need to change, we actually reject the double standard right now, where we accept that kids in the developing world are not getting what we would give our own kids here and what, you know, food programs, nutrition programs in the United States give young children.
We understand there had been a milk surplus, but when that subsided, that milk powder was removed from the relief aid in the 1980s.
Right. The fortified flour that is the main food that is given, supplemental food to malnourished kids, used to have milk powder in it, which is a critical ingredient. And it was removed, as you mentioned. There are new ways now. There are new pastes that deliver milk in a paste form.
You've talked about this.
Yeah.
It's very inexpensive. It's like a ball of, cookie dough is what it would look like. And it's just, it's so powerful. But why can't we get that to more young kids?
Well, I think we can. It's just it's a question of will, and it's a question of resources. A will of challenging the current kind of setup and the way we think about this. And secondly, resources. Far more resources are going to be needed. It is cheaper to give these kinds of flours, but we should reject that because they really don't meet the nutritional needs of kids. And these pastes are useful. There are other solutions as well, but the pastes are great because they allow kids to be treated at home. And we don't need to set up, complicated hospitals. We don't need to bring kids in intensive care units. We can actually give these pastes. Kids can be treated at home, and they recover. And we have an over 90% success rate, even for severely malnourished kids, with these kinds of ready-to-use foods, which are a real revolution in how we can tackle malnutrition.
And what are they made of?
Well, they're high energy, so they have a peanut butter or an ingredient like that, and they have the milk powder, and they have all the essential nutrients and vitamins that kids need.
And as you say, instead, cereals are going into relief foods. What's the disconnect there? Because we're hearing that part of the global food crisis is that a lot of these grains aren't getting to poor people, and yet they're going in relief foods, but that's not what's needed for young kids. So what?
Of course, there needs to be food aid for adults and families, and there the cereals are absolutely appropriate, and pulses, beans, and oil. And that's the standard ration, and that's fine, and it should happen. It should be delivered. All we're saying is that there needs to be a special focus and attention if we want to minimize the impact of these rising food prices on those who are most likely to be affected, most vulnerable, most likely to die, those are the kids, and those are the ones who suffer first. And so we have to really redirect our focus and make sure that they get the kind of nutritional supplements and the kinds of food that they need to develop and thrive.
That's Dr. Nicholas De Torrente, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you very much, Ron.
And a look at tomorrow on Here and Now. Young gay bloggers debate, is winning the right to same-sex marriage necessarily a good thing? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, airlines in America are hurting, but India and China are taking off. Why is that? That's after the news, Here and Now. As if baggage surcharges weren't enough, American Airlines today announced a $20 increase on all U.S. airfares because of soaring fuel prices. Just the latest in a spate of bad news from the industry. Continental cut 3,000 jobs last week, United and Delta having announced their own layoffs before that. But as airlines in America tighten their belts, others around the world are weathering the economic storm and in some cases even growing. Matthew Bishop is American business editor at The Economist. He says, it's not just oil prices that are a problem here in the U.S. It's too many traditional airlines in an outdated structure. Matthew, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think in America, for a long time, you've had the famous airlines like American or Continental that have had to cover every major airport in the country, every destination. And there's always been too many of them. And unfortunately, each time one of them gets into financial difficulties, it goes into Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and rather being put out of its misery, it comes out again without all the debts it had before and is able to compete with lower prices against the airlines that were actually well run. And so it's been really hard to make money in the airline business even when times are good. And so that's made them much less able to survive in difficult times like these without having to take drastic measures and measures that upset passengers by like putting up oil surcharges.
Well, you say that the low-cost budget airlines have it somewhat easier in that they can choose their routes and they can strip away and the amenities, and people expect that. But haven't even some of the low-cost been struggling?
Yes, I mean, every airline in the world is having to cope with the fact that oil prices are really, really high, approaching record levels in real terms, even if and certainly in nominal dollar terms. So, you know, when you're biggest cost is oil, and it's gone up two or three times what it was a couple of years ago, you're going to be under pressure. But the lower cost airlines at least have this ability to pick certain routes that have high demand, and no one expects frills when you do a low-cost airline, whereas you do expect to be treated well when you go on American.
Airlines like Southwest here in the U.S. have, you know, done quite well at, you know, making bets on what the market will be, on what the price of oil will be. Can you explain that a little bit more? And I guess, you know, how much longer can airlines do that?
Yes, I think some airlines have been better than others at predicting where the oil price is going. And as a result, they've entered into contracts with banks to limit the amount that the oil price they're going to have to pay goes up. And as a result, they've been able to cope quite well with the recent rise in the oil price without forcing passengers to pay more. The trouble is that the price at which the bank is willing to offer protection against oil price rises depends on what the bank thinks the price is going to be. And a lot of the deals that were done over the last couple of years by two airlines like Southwest, the banks assumed that the oil price would probably be about 50 or 60 at most. And now they're saying, well, it's $120, $130, maybe it's going to go to $200. And so obviously they're going to charge the airlines much, much more to provide a limit on how high the oil price they'll have to pay will go, which means that they won't have the kind of free pass from passing on costs to passengers that we've seen in the past couple of years. So I think even the most competitive airlines in the world are going to have to start charging more for their tickets because of the oil price increase.
Well, it's like when you lock in on a price of your home heating oil in advance, you can get it to stay at the lower price if it goes up. But you're saying that at a certain point, banks just won't be able to do that. They'll have to say, you know, it went up too far.
Yeah, you can only lock in for a year or two. And then after that, people say, well, hang on a minute. it's not worth it to us to lock you in at a price which we all know is well below what the going rate is in the market. So it's going to go up now.
Well, and then you've got Ryanair, which is the dominant budget airline in Europe, and the CEO has made some bullish comments. Apparently, he makes them quite a bit. But he's said that the downturn in the airline industry is needed. Is there some logic to what he's saying, or is he just bluffing?
Well, again, I think in Europe there's been a big problem where a lot of governments basically subsidized national airlines, airlines like Alitalia that probably never ever made a penny in their entire existence. And so you had uncompetitive airlines against competitive airlines. And one of the things that's happening at the moment is that the worst airlines are going to be driven out of business, which then means that well-run airlines like Ryanair, which is a budget airline a bit like Southwest, are able to actually grow and take business off the badly run airlines. So in the end, the hope is that only the best will survive, which should mean a more sustainable industry in the long run.
Well, and then there is growth of air travel, even as airlines here in the U.S. are cutting back, not in Europe, but in Asia and India. China building 97 new regional airports in the next 12 years, air travel there rising about 25% a year. They see it as fueling economic growth. Tell us a little bit about how the airline industry is growing in both China and India.
Well, this is a story we're going to have to get used to in America and the rich world. In many industries besides air travel, basically the real growth stories in the world are going to be coming from places like India and China. And you're right, I mean, they haven't had the sort of air travel that we've been used to here in the past, and they're now going to invest in the airlines and airports and so forth that that will make them able to travel as easily as we do, and it's going to be a huge boom in that industry, and you're going to start to see more companies like India's Jet Airlines coming to America and competing against the American airlines, and possibly because they're a new airline without any of the historical cost legacies that the American airlines have, they may actually produce better service at cheaper fares. You know, when you want to fly to India, you'll probably go with Jet Air rather than with Continental or American.
Well, there's speculation that, in growing airlines, this is a good time to do it because you can use more fuel-efficient, newer airplanes. But on the other side, with the credit crunch, won't some of these startup airlines have trouble getting money?
Well, you're right. I mean, if you look at some of the airlines that have gone out of business in the last few weeks, one or two of them have been airlines like Silverjet, which was doing this business-only fare from New York to London. And it's not been able to raise the money it needed to stay in business, even though I think many people felt it had actually produced a good popular service that customers wanted. They just weren't quite willing to pay enough to keep it through this difficult time. So, yeah, it is a bad time if you are short of money. But if you've got money to invest and you know how to run an airline well, in the long run, air travel is going to be a booming industry, I think.
Well, and some have said we might start seeing more direct flights to Beijing or connections in New Delhi rather than in Europe or Japan. On the other hand, is there a certain psychological factor here? Americans have gotten used to outsourcing quite a few things. Are they willing to so wholeheartedly outsource their travel because of safety concerns? I mean, is there a concern that there's oversight of American airlines that there might not be in other countries?
Well, I suspect it's going to be a long time before Indian airlines or Chinese airlines are running the domestic routes in America that we are all used to traveling on. Although, we have seen Virgin, which is a British company, come in and do very well, offering very competitive service in America over the last year or so. So I think it's going to be a long-run trend, but it'll be a while before some countries make us feel comfortable about flying their airlines.
That's Matthew Bishop, American business editor at The Economist. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And don't forget, while there, you can listen to Here and Now stream live or download a podcast. That's here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. David Sedaris. I probably don't have to say anything more. You're probably already thinking hilarious Christmas elf, improbable superstar of Ira Glass's This American Life on NPR. David Sedaris is out with his sixth book. It's a compilation of stories called When You Are Engulfed in Flames, which he took from a disaster preparedness pamphlet in a Tokyo hotel. My personal favorite of the English he found in Japan was the incomprehensible but sweet saying on a gift bag, When I think about the life in my own way, I need gentle conversation. Boy, who doesn't? Let's have a gentle conversation with David Sedaris. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Another gift bag that I found in Tokyo, it said, only inflowing, you don't flowing, inflowing.
What does that mean? What is that?
Well, it was like finding poetry. I mean, you would ponder. You would only inflowing, you don't flowing, inflowing. I thought about that for a long, long time.
Well, did you ever find out what to do when you are engulfed in flames in a hotel room in Tokyo?
You know, I never got further than that. I was howling with laughter when I saw when you are engulfed in flames. Because at that point, it seems kind of too late to do anything, doesn't it? Or you'd think, what did I read in the hotel room? Like, what did I read? What did I read?
Well, you were in Tokyo to quit smoking. What were you thinking?
Well, I was actually pretty smart for several reasons. In Tokyo, it's against the law to smoke on the street. You have to go to a special outdoor ashtray. But it's not because of secondhand smoke. The law was enacted because so many people were getting burned with lit cigarettes.
Tell us about this.
Such great crowds of people that people were getting... It's about a hole in a Comme des Garçons jacket. It's not about inhaling somebody else's.
Going up in flames,
right.
Yes.
So you couldn't smoke outside. But inside, you could smoke your head off. And sometimes when you quit, you want to be around a lot of smoke. So this was terrific. You could go indoors and get all the smoke that you wanted. Also, I really need a cigarette when I'm talking on the phone. But right now, here in Boston, it's already August in Tokyo. Like, that's how profound the time change is. And I figured no one would ever call me, and nobody ever did.
So you didn't need to smoke. Well, giving up smoking was more than just giving up smoking. It was a part of giving up a part of your outsider status, you know, squeezing into smoking rooms at airports. You write about that in the section of the book called The Smoking Section. Would you read that about what some of these places were like and the same kinds of people that you saw in these kinds of smoking rooms?
I go on these lecture tours twice a year, generally, every fall and every spring. And I would be rerouted. I would have them reroute me through cities with smoking tanks. So the ones in Salt Lake City were kept in good condition, but those in St. Louis and Atlanta were miniature glass-walled slums, ashtrays never emptied, trash on the ground, air ducts exposed and sagging from the caramel-colored ceiling. Then there were the people. My old friend with a hole in his throat was always there, as was his wife, who had a suitcase in one hand and an oxygen tank in the other. Alongside her were the servicemen from Abu Ghraib, two prisoners handcuffed to federal agents, and the Jode family. It was a live anti-smoking commercial, and those passing by would often stop and point, especially if they were with children. See that lady with the tube taped to her nose? Is that what you want to happen to you? But that's what those tanks are like. I haven't yet come to an airport. Oh, actually, no, I was in Greensboro, North Carolina the other day, and they had a tank there, but I was running from my gate. But otherwise, I would have gone in just to...
For old time's sake?
Just for old time's sake. I think that's what I miss more than anything about not smoking, is I miss my rage.
At being corralled. Do you worry that success, that staying now in nice smoke-free hotels, will take away what one reviewer called your outsider loser edge?
No, I worried a bit, though, in writing this book, because I wrote quite a few of the essays have to do with my life right now. I'm at the Four Seasons, and someone sent a cake to my room, but I'm too timid to call downstairs and ask for silverware, so I cut it with my credit card. My fear is that people are going to think, what the hell does he have to complain about? He's staying at the Four Seasons. But I would like to insist that you can still...
Complain.
You can still complain, or you can still, you know, when you're on a book tour, people pay attention to you, and this is all very nice and everything, but it has nothing to do with my regular life.
Like right now, your jacket has turned into a straitjacket as you're trying to take it off and practically hanging yourself. That's David Sedaris. His new book of essays is When You Are Engulfed in Flames. Some of the pieces appeared previously in The New Yorker or on NPR's This American Life. They are David's observations on life's incidents, gleaned from growing up one of six children in North Carolina, living now in Paris and London, quitting drinking and smoking along the way, and missing the airport smoking rooms, home to people with lung cancer and Abu Ghraib guards. The stories are from David's carefully kept diaries and notebooks. And I can see from my side of the table, you've got a little notebook now that you're jotting in. I see little upside-down scribbles. What are some of the things you write about?
Well, like the first thing on this page is the names of the people who worked at the bookstore last night, because I'll write them a thank you letter. And then beneath that, I'm always looking for things to sign in books. And last night I wrote something that I think might work. Thank you for touching my heart. That might work.
Well, in the new book, you write about a sister showing you animal pornography, the babysitters your parents hired. Your parents didn't seem to care that the babysitters abducted you. Your mother, you write, put cigarette packs in your Easter basket, and another point says, I hope you choke when you're eating.
To death.
To death. Is there anything about your family and loved ones in particular that you've regretted writing or sharing?
Not about my family. Like, my dad got upset one time because I wrote something about my grandmother. And it wasn't untrue what I wrote about my grandmother. I think my father wished that it hadn't been true. My father, you know, when you're Greek, you don't put your relatives in a nursing home. And my father put his mother in a nursing home. Oh. But he was sort of forced to by my... It was my mother or my grandmother. One of them had to go. So I wrote about that.
This isn't the grandmother that you write about in this book, who's the litterer.
Yes, yes, the litter bug, the Greek litter bug. But I think it was being reminded of what life was like when she lived with us. I think that was what troubled him. I wrote something once about a teacher of mine, a French teacher, and if I could take that back, I would. Everything in the story was true. She was, when I first moved to Paris, I took a French class, and the teacher threw chalk at us, and she would get up in your face and mock you, and she stabbed a Korean girl in the eye with a pencil and told her to wake up or go back to Seoul.
Seems like you should have called the police.
Well, I wrote about her, but what I didn't write was that I really liked her. Nannies are often exploited in France. We had these Eastern Europeans in our class who lived with families and were being forced to work longer hours than they should have and under horrible conditions. And our teacher called their employees. She did some remarkable things, and I really liked her. And I didn't mention that in the story. It was my laziness. I hurt her through my laziness. And I wrote her a letter, but I can't take the story back. But I think about her a lot. When I'm writing something, I think, all right, am I doing this again?
Huh. That's interesting. We were thinking about the time, and we really don't need to go into the details about this, but the time that your boyfriend, Hugh, lanced your boil, which produced that hilarious line that you called him Sir Lancelot. But that was a tough one to read.
Well, the New Yorker cut a bit of that, some of the descriptions, but I reinstated them in the published story just because I'd worked so hard on those.
On the disgusting aspect of it. How much of it is true?
How much of it a write is true?
Yeah.
Well, I put in the book I wrote that the stories were real-ish because there's a story in here about me going to Princeton during the Stone Age, and I didn't. And so that was the whole reason I put the real-ish thing in this book.
Well, you know why I ask, because the New Republic's Alex Hurd did an incredibly detailed investigation of your stories, digging up, you know, the manager of the Macy's where you were the elf and high school teachers, and found that, okay, you did work at a mental hospital in North Carolina when you were young, but you did not get bit on the arm by an old lady who was naked on a gurney.
No, actually, I had written that I had volunteered at a mental institution when I was 15, and I had written that the buildings were Gothic, and apparently the buildings are Tuscan Revival. Then he could not prove that I had been bitten by a woman when I worked there. And so he decided that it wasn't true. But it was true.
That part was true.
Yeah. I mean, just because he couldn't prove it doesn't mean that it wasn't true. Like, if I can't name the orderly who was with me when I was 15 and say, oh, you can call him, am I therefore not allowed to write about it? I mean, he said that he had submitted things to his sniff test. Well, I have a sniff test, too, and I think he stinks. I mean, his big smoking gun was that I got the style wrong. I went to speech therapy when I was in fifth grade. I'd referred to speech therapy as Future Homosexuals of America. So he called my elementary school principal and said, did you round up suspected homosexuals and send them to speech class? And I never expected anyone to take that seriously. That was like a joke. And I'm trying to think of what his third thing was.
I think it was the couple that you've written about a couple of times that picked you up when you were young and wanted to engage you in a threesome, and you told the story slightly differently in a couple places. In one place, the woman's wearing a negligee, and one place she's not. I think that was it. But you've even said that this real-ishness applies to a lot of your writing, that there's a basic truth.
Oh, I exaggerate like crazy, but I've always admitted to it, and I've written about how much I exaggerate, and I exaggerate about how much I exaggerate.
Well, I'm thinking, too, that I'm guessing those guys from Abu Ghraib were not in that smoking room with you in Salt Lake City.
No, they weren't.
And
the Joad family wasn't in there either.
I'm guessing.
Well, plus, I mean, I'm writing humor, and I suppose I see a difference between that and being a reporter. I've never claimed to be a reporter. You know, with the New Yorker, I mean, they have incredibly rigorous fact checkers, so I can't exaggerate nearly as much as I'd like to. But still, the New Yorker doesn't fact check jokes. When I go to Germany for a book tour, they say, "How did you come up with this character of David?" And I say, "Well, it's me." "And how did you come up with the mother?" I said, "Well, that's my mother, who I wrote." "Why did you decide they lived in Raleigh, North Carolina?" I'd say, "Well, that's where I grew up, in Raleigh, North Carolina." And I love that they just, I can't get them to because they don't really have this sort of writing there.
So there, they want it to be fiction. And here, you know, they're asking you if it's the truth. But can you understand that, you know, you sort of have to ask?
I can understand that. I would want to know.
Do you find now, David, that, I mean, now you're David Sedaris and you've got your little notepad. Do you find your friends kind of like backing away from you? Like, are rooms getting quiet when you come in, or people like?
Generally, the room gets louder. People tend to say, "Oh, here's something you can write about."
Do they?
Oh, yeah, but it's usually not.
Yeah, that becomes a problem then.
I mean, that said, I mean, like my sister Lisa, I was at her house the other day and something happened and she just looked at me and she said, "No." You know, before I could even ask, she said, "No." So, I mean, if I write something about someone in my family, I give it to them first and I say, "Is there anything you want me to change or to take out?" And my dad one time wanted me to take something out of a story I'd written about my brother. My brother had no problem with it, but my dad did. And so I took it out, and my father was so right, because when I even tell people this, that the atmosphere in the room changes. I just always thought it was funny, but my dad was right. It would have just changed everything to keep that in there.
Well, then we're not going to ask you to tell it now.
I wouldn't.
There you go. That's David Sedaris. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to us.
Oh, thank you for having me.